Icon Art Radio.
It's Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and it's Icon Art Radio, and it's 1 week later from last week when we talked about time. Time, I've always defined as space changing. I think you defined time last week as the flow of...
Flow and change.
Flow and change, but... I could never separate the two things, time and space, and I guess the physicists really get deeply into that. But for me, there would be no time if I couldn't see spatial objects changing in front of my face. So space and time are very integrally connected. So I thought, although they're one, we gave heavy emphasis on this word time last time. Let's throw space out there and see where it goes. Anybody got anything to say about space?
The final frontier. Well, I'm a very spatial person. It's funny, we think of spatially oriented people in terms of visual spatial orientation. And one of the reasons that my studio is a mess is because that's a form of organization. It's sort of time-based, but it's also very spatial in that I know in my mind's eye where I put something, and I can find it without looking for it because I know where to go to find it. And so if someone were to clean everything up, then everything would be in a different place, and I wouldn't be able to find it unless I was the one doing the cleaning up, of course. But my greater interest in space is in the sound work that I do, where it's the spaciousness of things that appeals to me. Hmm. Not so much the position of things in space, but that there is a space in which you can position things.
Wow, that's very cool. That's very cool because, I mean, this relates back to last week when we were talking about time. And remember, I said I wanted to have this a day of this that was really flowing and not chopped up, and I called it a spacious day.
That's right. That's
so
right.
It was related to time, but that's the feeling, is that wanting more space of mm-hmm. time. Because I always thought I was not a spatially oriented person because I have a terrible sense of direction. I can be walking around in a city that I've walked around in a million times and get completely turned around and go five blocks mm-hmm. in the wrong direction because I don't have this good sense. So I thought that was like a bad spatial orientation. But in terms of time, I have an amazing sense of space. I know exactly how long it takes me to do any particular thing and how long it takes me to get someplace. Mm-hmm. So now my logic is just getting completely mixed up and tangled together.
Well, in Vaisheshika philosophy, the sequence of manifestation begins with manas and atman, or we could think of that as, you know, the cosmic movie screen and the cosmic eyeball. And for those of you who aren't reading Vaisheshika on a regular basis. And then the next, sort of in separating the observer from that which is observed, a pressure is required to kind of hold them apart, to divide what's essentially unity into duality. And that pressure gives rise, curiously enough, first to time. And then pressure over time gives rise to space.
Hmm.
Now, for those who do read Vaisheshika, pressure is usually translated as direction, but that's kind of silly in English because direction requires space in order to even have any meaning. But unmanifest direction is what pressure is. It's an energy in a direction that hasn't moved yet. But when I first thought about this, the idea that, that pressure over time gives rise to space, I thought, boy, that's really abstract. And then I thought, no, wait a minute, I just described the physiology of hearing. It's the eardrum sitting there responding to pressure, which varies over time, and gives us this experience of sound, which intrinsically includes a visceral notion of volumetric space.
And space, I mean, I'm going to depart completely because you... The abstraction. I can't follow along in this abstraction here.
Oh, Donna.
If you don't mind, I'm going to take it to
a level that's actually
confusing.
So you just talked, because that's what got sparked in me. You talked about the eardrum and the sound and all that. And immediately, because I'm not a sound artist, my even as a writer, I think more visually. But what came to my mind was the difference in the visual experience of big spaces, small spaces, space itself. You know, even when you see a film, like you're at Disneyland and you're riding in one of those things that makes you feel like you're in a spaceship going through the cosmos. What that does to you inside, just seeing that visually, you know, even flying in an airplane makes you feel differently than when you're walking down the street. And, same thing in a room. If you're in a big house or a tiny little room, everything inside, the pressure of your emotions even can change just because of this different quality of space around you.
Yeah.
But have you ever sat in a small room and then felt it in totally expansive, endless space?
Yeah.
That's this combination that's magic. We were talking about magic last week. Yeah. There's a point of magic here where we connect with infinite space all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I'm after in my compositions. I'm trying to explore that sensation. I'm trying to find out, you know, what is it, what it really points to. And ironically, without having a very large room with eight, you know, speaker columns 30 feet apart, the best way to recreate the spatial experience that I'm playing with is with headphones, which is the smallest room you can put your head in. And so you put a pair of headphones on, and you're now completely confined. But then this binaural recording, you know, establishes points in three-dimensional sound space that that might be miles away from your head and moving, and you you have that sort of simultaneity of you know, being very confined and very unbounded at the same time.
Looking at a painting even can do that to you.
You
know, you're standing in front of one little painting that can be even quite a small painting, and yet you're where it takes you is phenomenal.
And this is that projected space that's in our minds. That's the beauty of the rectangle of the painting, is that it's just a rectangle of canvas or paper, and you're nowhere. You're confronted with a boundary. And then all of a sudden, the magic window, I call it, of the painting opens you up into a mental space experience, like a dream, that, and you're no longer confined. You have been liberated.
Well, and if you start with this, you know, with your appointment list in your head, and you know, the linear time of what you're supposed to be doing, and all these layers of self-image and identity and social interaction and things. Generally speaking, whatever you put your attention on is sort of all you're aware of for the duration that your attention is on it. And I mean, that's the tragedy of waking state, is that it's true unity consciousness. You're only aware of the thing that you're looking at. You've completely lost track of who's doing the looking. But that's why if you look at a work of art that has some expansive quality to it, you can be completely overshadowed by an object of perception, but it's an object of perception that reflects the observer, and that reflects infinity, and reflects something larger than you know, a clock or an appointment book or a clerk behind the counter waiting for you to hand them a dollar bill.
Well, and your sound work too. To go back to how you were talking about sound, when I listen to sounds, whatever they are, your recordings, you know, that you gave us a CD a few weeks ago of some of your sound experiments, if I put those on, or like my son's electronic music or swing band music or anything, after a short period of time, I have to get up and start moving because it makes my body want to move in space. Yeah. To those sounds, and I don't even consider it dancing, really. It's more like, I more feel like almost like a cartoon character that's just like moving around in certain ways, and that feels really, I feel more connected to the music if my body is moving around when I'm listening to it.
Yeah,
but I don't, you know, we watch people dancing and we watch their bodies moving in a room, but what's happening inside is that they are flowing in this space, this sound space, which is another room altogether, and much bigger, and much and that's a sort of the magic of dancing to me, is and moving to music, and is that I'm moving in, you know, you close your eyes and you're like, especially in the kind of dancing I remember doing in the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco, you close your eyes and you are in that space, which is the space that you're playing with your sound.
Yeah, and interestingly, the sense of hearing is, as I like to say, an elaboration of the sense of touch. And the kinesthetic sense of where your body is and where your arms and legs are, you know, you can close your eyes and you know that your left hand is on the left side of your body still, or it's not reaching around to, you know, surprise you by poking you in the ear on the right. And that sense of body position is a fundamental definition of space. It's it's another way of defining space. So when your attention is on hearing, I guess it's not surprising that, you know, the body would want to sort of get connected to that process, since it really is, you know, the entire sensory portion of the nervous system is tied into that experience of space.
And yet there are people, in fact, it baffled me until I actually talked to somebody who did this, and then I understood. It puzzled me how someone could sit in a concert of, like, wonderful music and not move at all, just sit perfectly still. Because I always had to move around a little bit anyway, and but I talked to somebody who was like that one time, and she said, "Oh, she was traveling. She was definitely moving. She just wasn't moving her body." And it's like what you were talking about, Bill, of this, the inner space, mentally or emotionally or whatever, that she was magically soaring through, flying through, moving in ways that her physical body couldn't even begin to move.
Yeah.
And I had that experience because I was always the one in the past that would go to concerts and move my body. And I went to a concert one time with Steve Giacomini, and it was somebody that we really were into. And I think we were both so into this mental space and so into it, and we were so deeply affected that we were just not moving. But we were moving inside.
Yeah.
But there were people around us that thought we were just like the coldest, unfeeling.
Yeah, not getting it.
And like we were not getting it. And these people had to remark to us, like, what? You know, I don't even remember what they said, but it was something. And Steve and I just looked at each other, like, God. they have no idea.
Well, I can no longer listen to classical music in a concert. I can't do it. I cannot be that motionless, and it's not just It's not that I want to jump up and dance when I hear Beethoven, because I don't, but I sort of like to conduct Beethoven, and I'd hate for anyone to see me doing it. And so I can't, you know, and in a concert hall, not only are you supposed to not conduct, but, you know, you're not supposed to make a sound. You're supposed to act like you're not there. And I just can't do that. I enjoy the music too much to, you know, I want to lean forward in my seat and move around a little and, you know, maybe even get up and walk around while I'm listening to it. And I listen to music at home. I play classical in a concert format at home. I sit on the couch and I crank up the speakers and I listen to one particular piece from beginning to end. And it's just like going to a concert. And very often I won't move for a substantial portion of that time. But the feeling that I mustn't move is what ruins it for me. It puts me into this sort of half-sleeping state. And if I go to a concert, I will fall asleep listening to music that I, you know, that's my absolute favorite in all the world.
Can I tell the story of my first encounter with real classical music? Because it just popped into my head when you were saying. This was during the 60s when I was in New York City and was in the habit of going to loud rock concerts and dancing madly to all of them. And I was walking down uptown towards Christmas time, doing Christmas shopping or something, down 57th Street, and walked by Carnegie Hall. And there was a big crowd of people all dressed up waiting to go in to hear Vladimir Horowitz give a concert. And I sort of, you know, vaguely knew who Vladimir Horowitz was. But as I was walking by, this young, kind of nerdy guy was standing there about my age. And he had a ticket he was trying to give away. He said, I have an extra ticket. My friend couldn't come with me. And, you know, I was one of the people that he approached. And he said several people had turned him down because they just were suspicious or something. And he said it was a box seat. You know, we'll have this box to ourselves and, you know, you get to hear Vladimir Horowitz. And I was innocent enough to say, well, is he good? And the guy was like, yeah,
he's really good. Carter have pills?
And so, so I said yes. And I was wearing some, I even remember what I was wearing. I was wearing these like black bell-bottom pants and an old like military jacket, you know, with brass buttons and epaulets and everything. Not dressed for the thing, but it was the 60s, you know, and so I said, all right, I will go, I'll go. And it was, I've never forgotten how that felt to me, because it completely took me by surprise. Being in that space of Carnegie Hall, for one thing, was amazing. Yeah. And then as soon as he started playing, I never knew music could transport you the way that concert did. Yeah. And I really felt like I was on another planet.
Yeah.
And so that was a great boon. And this young man just, you know, we went to his father's restaurant that his father owned a few blocks away, ate dinner. I got on the bus, went home, and never saw the kid again. But it was a gift from the gods, that moment. And
No, that's really interesting. I'm also fascinated by the different ways in which paintings and audio convey the idea of space. I was talking to Lawrence Schieff about this some time ago, and you know, from his perspective, the painting is kind of the ultimate, you know, most fundamental of all possible sensory experiences. And I see it differently because I'm a different person. But it seems to me that sound invokes space very, very quickly and unmistakably. Whereas a visual image, you have to analyze it. You know, you have to scan it. You have to look around on it to see if it is, in fact, a perspective image or not. Especially if it's a little bit impressionistic or pointillistic, you know, if it's not just photorealist. You can, for example, looking at it upside down, it definitely doesn't make sense. You don't see the spatiality in it upside down. You have to turn it right side up before you begin to see the vanishing points and compute a sense of that this is a representation of something in volumetric space.
Unless it's a different kind of space that you're perceiving, you know, where you're looking at something very flattened out, like a Japanese print or something like that, where it's purposely made flat and two-dimensional, but you can enter that spatially in a different way.
Right. And well, I wasn't thinking so much of the style. I mean, obviously, there's another kind of space in a Rothko that is inescapable. But there's a kind of analytical period involved for me anyway when I look at a visual image, where I'm recognizing and identifying and classifying and looking at relationships, and that's part of the kind of the dynamics of the composition. Your eye has to follow certain paths, and if they're interesting ones, we call it a good composition, and if they're, you know, boring ones, we don't maybe like the composition as much. But, you know, you have to understand something about it to know that those, you know, shapes are parts of an object rather than objects in their own right. Those paint, you know, globs are not simply areas of color, they are representing shadows. And the thing is, the brain, you know, contributes so much to this process before we become aware of it, that colors, I mean, we've sort of touched on this talking about, you know, Rembrandt and how he painted colors that really weren't there. And did it without using those colors that weren't there. But when you look at it, you see the brain, you know, finishes the colorizing of the image because it knows what it's looking at. And if it doesn't know what it's looking at, then it doesn't do that. So the, you know, blobs of a certain color with other blobs of a particular group of colors, if it's abstract, you'll see that first color for what it is. If it's not abstract, you won't be able to see that first color for what it is. You will see it as a different color. And it's only when you cover up its surroundings that you'll be able to see that actually it isn't the color you thought you were looking at.
So the point you were making.
Was I making a point?
Well, was that music sort of grabs you and you're in your.
It seems to be. I'm not exactly.
I didn't follow every place you went there in terms of the comparison, but I do know that when music seems to like overwhelm my soul and draw me in, or sound things seem to have that effect. I don't know if we have quite the visual dream vehicle available that's as engrossing and as music. I mean, if I look a photograph, I'm pretty well lost in the illusion of space. But where are we?
Well, I guess I was just feeling that it takes some kind of interpretation that may happen very fast, but it seems like it's not quite automatic. It seems like it's a little bit, it's like the pictures, visual images seem to operate with more of a vocabulary. They're more evolved than sound.
Do you think this has to do with the senses themselves or with the form of art? Because like when you were talking about when you hear something and you're just, you know, you react immediately, what came to my mind was like visual things. Like the other day I was walking when it was snowing on, was it Saturday or something? And it was snowed for in the afternoon. And I walked by my two windows in my kitchen and these snowflakes were coming down and the colors and the lighting outside was just a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it completely took me, it was like watching this gorgeous artistic scene in a movie that took me to another land or whatever. It was the most beautiful thing. And I just stood there and watched the snow falling outside my window silently. So I guess my question is, when you talked about the analysis that you have to do on the visual level, Do you think that's something about the sense of hearing as opposed to the sense of sight, or about visual art as opposed to music?
I think it probably has a lot to do with the temporal aspect of it, the fact that, as you put it, you know, it's like a movie mm-hmm. as opposed to like a photograph. Mm. Once you eliminate time, once you freeze the image, then, you know, it could be anything, because we learn so much from the motion. I mean, it's instantly separates objects, you know, from fields, and that doesn't necessarily happen visually until something has, you know, changed.
So here we go back to where we started out, this whole discussion of the relationship between time and space, yeah. that they're inseparable.
Yeah, they're certainly certainly inseparable. I don't know if there'd be much you could do with either one of them without the other. But then again, with only time and space, there isn't much to do either. The thing is, though, inseparable as they are, I'm convinced of the illusory nature of time. I mean, the subjective time is really the only time that seems to count. It's you know, the time as I experience it. I don't care if someone tells me that, you know, 15 minutes have gone by or 3 hours. If I'm in an airport, 15 minutes is like 3 hours, and 3 hours is like a month. That seems, in the end, to be more relevant than, mm-hmm. you know, what the clock says.
And yet there's something beautiful about
it. Is it because of the space you're in?
Yeah. It's just because of the appointment that I have.
And there's something beautiful about the cycles of time, too. It's time not as a linear thing, but
right.
like the seasons and things like that,
right.
you know, where it just, you get tuned into a different aspect of life
sure.
at a different time in the year.
And the time becomes the mayo between the two pieces of bread.
Right.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.